Direito? Tonight's lesson is on a topic that makes me a little bit nervous. I don't mind telling you that. Tonight we're going to talk about pain. And this is one of those lessons, or this is one of those topics that sometimes we say things in life and we want to say, knock on wood. Well, this is one of those lessons you want to say, knock on wood about. You don't want this to come past for any of us. I feel like I've got a little bit of a unique perspective on pain, but I want to preface this lesson by saying that certainly I don't want you to think that I'm making light of pain, because that's not the case. I could never think of a state of mind that I was ever in where severe pain seemed anything less than completely intolerable. I've seen some terrible things and witnessed some terrible situations. And when we talk about pain, we're going to talk about it in sort of an intellectual point of view, looking at it without thinking about really how we go through it, how we deal with it. We're going to look at it on the surface of what it is. So it's not that I'm making light of it at all. In fact, given the nature of my work, my goodness, I've seen some folks that have had terrible, terrible pain. Terrible pain. I want to share with you just a few stories. These are true stories. Sometimes you hear stories about folks and you read them in books, but these are people that I work with. There was a man, and I know that you know this type of thing exists, a man who got hurt when he was younger, working construction type work, and he had several surgeries to try to correct his pain. All of them had failed. He continued to have pain. Naturally, he depended on medication to help him. Well, you know how that goes. Pain continues, the medication gets where it doesn't help as much. He needed more and more medication. He needed the strong medication to help him get relief. OxyContin, strong medication. Got to where that didn't help. Now he takes methadone. Very strong medication to help him with his pain. He says the doctors don't believe him. I don't know if I believe him either. But we see situations like this where people have got chronic pain that stays with them a long time. Of course, there are folks who have pain after surgery. Perhaps one of the most painful surgeries that I know of is a knee replacement. I bet I've worked with hundreds, if not 500 or 1,000 different people that have had knee replacement surgeries. Everyone is a little bit different, but they are all very painful. And I always tell those folks that I can't identify with them because of their pain. I've never had it, but I work with so many people. I know it's real, and I know it's terrible, and I have to encourage them in spite of it. Michelle had probably the worst pain of anybody I've ever seen 2 months back. Terrible episodes of pain. I know some of you have had terrible pain as well. All this is physical pain. Physical pain. And I've unfortunately had to work with people in such ways to cause physical pain, knowing that it was to their benefit to stretch their arm or stretch their joint or to try to help them get stronger. And it's a challenge to try to push these folks. Let's talk for a minute about a different kind of pain. I want to tell you about two examples that are very hard. A young girl. She was probably between 16 and 18. Going through a little bit of a wild phase. She got in with the wrong crowd and went with some boys she didn't know with another friend who she hung out with and became so intoxicated she passed out. They proceeded to rape the girls and on their way down the mountain had a terrible wreck, killed the other girl, and this girl wound up in ICU for probably 2 months. She had 2 years of rehabilitation and now has brain injury. And it was terrible to see and witness her mother during this time because her mother lost grip of her during that short period of time, and that girl's life was changed forever as a result of it.
that mother had terrible pain.
Just this past week, another episode happened, and I was forced to make a decision. See, a lot of times with my work, we help people get better. We help them improve, but sometimes it's my job to look out for the best interest of the patient and the staff, and that's what I had to do in this particular instance. A young woman in her probably late 50s had a very severe stroke, and it paralyzed her left side almost completely. She had therapy while she was in the early stages, but when I met her and worked with her, it had been 18 months since her stroke, and she was not having any more return in function of her left side. Her leg was useless, her arm was useless, all she had was her right side. This woman was forced to stay in the nursing home because no one was able to provide for her in her home. She was there, being young and in her right mind, although she was somewhat affected by the stroke, being young and in her right mind, that's what she wanted to leave. Well, we had worked with her with therapy in the early stages. We didn't make any progress. And after 2 months, we had to dismiss her from therapy because we didn't make progress. It took a lot of effort of 2 therapists to stand her and to walk just a few feet. Well, there are some folks in nursing homes that help carry on that activity after therapy is finished. And she had been working with them for a year. She was also a diabetic and didn't manage her diabetes. And in that year, she had gained 100 pounds. So for this woman who was very hard to lift in the beginning, now she was extremely hard to lift. I was asked to do something very hard. I was asked to go in and to assess whether or not she needed to continue to walk for safety issues. I saw immediately she couldn't. It was too much risk. The risk of her walking 5 feet was greater than the benefit of that much exercise. I had to tell her that. And she wailed. And she cried. And her daughter was there with her, and they both cried. All this time, she had been in denial of her situation, and then to talk about it, it was terrible to talk about it, and to make her face reality was terrible, terrible emotional pain. Which brings us to this question, why does this kind of stuff happen? Why do we have to face physical pain that won't relent? Why are there conditions like fibromyalgia that people get, and I believe it's a real thing, that affects them? It affects them in so many ways, and it doesn't go away. Why is it that there are conditions like these strokes and like a brain injury that can take away the life of a young person, although they're still living? Why? Make some people turn their back on God. We talked this morning about Naomi. Remember Naomi? When she came back into Israel, she said, God has not worked with me well. God has looked evil, worked wickedly with me. And that wasn't the case. There was a bigger plan happening for her. It works like this. We can't know good without evil. We can't understand it because it takes away the context for us. If we went through life without knowing pain, we could never understand pleasure. If we played a game of checkers, you and I, and every so often you messed up and I let you get away with it so that we have fun and have good camaraderie. If that happened every so often, that wouldn't be so bad. But if every single time you made a mistake and I caught you in it, I gave it back to you, there'd be no point in playing the game, would there? There'd be no game at all. I believe God can work miracles. I truly do. I think we can all see some in this room. We know of some. But if in every situation we needed God to come in and bail us out and work a miracle, then He'd be working miracles all the time and we would not appreciate them. So, what I want us to talk about for a little while is pain And I want us to look into the Old Testament at some pain that God led his prophets into. We've talked so far about a couple of aspects of pain. Physical pain, and we talked about emotional pain. And that's just different aspects of our lives. When we feel heat, when it's cold and we're the appropriate distance from it, it feels good. If we get too close, we get burned. So you see, heat in relation to pain, it's just a degree. And really what we're getting is we're getting that is a portion of our life. Physical pain is a portion of our life. So is mental pain. We've got mental bliss, and then we have pain, and then we have our spirituality as well. Now, what I hope we can gain by looking at what God led some of these folks into is the correct perspective for our spiritual lives. We want to talk tonight about the pain of the prophets, and our story begins with kind of looking back at the history of Israel and the history of Judah. The first prophet we're going to look at is Jeremiah. If you'd like to turn to Jeremiah chapter 27, I'm going to give you a little bit of history of what's happening during this time. There was a good, if you remember, we've got two nations, Israel and Judah. Judah had a good king in Josiah. He was king for a long time. Right after his death, Jehoahaz was king for only 3 months. He wasn't so good. Jehoiakim was king after him. Jehoiakim was king for 11 years, and he was not good either. And then following Jehoiakim was Jehoiachin. And Jehoiachin was king for 3 months before Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon came and took the city of Jerusalem. But there was not just one wave of the Babylonians that came across Jerusalem. There were three. And the first one, Daniel, the prophet, was taken into the land. We remember all about Daniel and how he was led to meet Nebuchadnezzar to interpret his dream. In the second wave, Ezekiel was taken. So Daniel lived a life there of luxury inside the king's palace. Ezekiel led the life of a common person, both of them in captivity. Jeremiah lived in the same time, and he witnessed these events. Jeremiah lived to see Babylon come and take Jerusalem, and wrote the book of Lamentations after they were all gone. He was able to stay behind, and that's when he penned those words, weeping and sorrowful about what had happened. There's a concept that we see in the life of the prophets. It's got a special name. It's called pedagogy and biography. And all that means is there was times in history that God needed to illustrate to the people a point. And because they were oblivious to God, he wanted to drive it home in the life of the prophet. The prophet lived out before them what he was prophesying. In this particular instance, we see something that is not too difficult for Jeremiah to do. In the beginning of the reign of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, came this word unto Jeremiah from the Lord, saying, so here we are, Jehoiakim reigned for 11 years. He was not a good king. The beginning of his reign, he gets this instructions. Thus saith the Lord to me, make thee bonds and yokes and put them upon thy neck. Bonds and yokes, like we put on cattle. This kind of a yoke that would go around his neck. And he had to wear that. And if anyone asked him why he was wearing it, let's look at what he would say. Verse 6, the first line there. I have given these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. He's speaking for God. Verse 7. And all nations shall serve him. Look at verse 8. And it shall come to pass that the nation and kingdom which will not serve the same Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and that will not put their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, that nation will I punish, saith the Lord, with the sword and with famine and with the pestilence, until I have consumed them by his hand. Therefore hearken not to your prophets, nor to your diviners, nor to your dreamers, nor to your enchanters, nor to your sorcerers, which speak unto you, saying, you shall not serve the king of Babylon. For they prophesy a lie unto you, to remove you far from your land, that I should drive you out, and you should perish. But the nations that bring their neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him, those will I let remain and still on their own land, saith the Lord, and they shall till it and dwell therein. So this is nothing terribly painful, but Jeremiah is forced to wear this around. How long? I don't know. But he wore it long enough that he got into a public debate with another prophet about this very prophecy. Perhaps he wore it for a few weeks, perhaps a year, I don't know. But he wore this physically. Now, I know that that got to be uncomfortable, but that wasn't so painful, not compared to what Ezekiel went through. Turn over a few pages. Ezekiel chapter 4. You remember Ezekiel was taken into captivity in the second wave. So he was there before the walls of Jerusalem were breached. He was there with the captives, and God gave him a prophecy to share with all the people about what was coming for Jerusalem. Thou also, Ezekiel chapter 4, thou also, son of man, take thee a tile and lay it before thee, and portray it upon the city, even Jerusalem. In other words, take a tile and write Jerusalem on it so everybody knows that this is what you're dealing with. And lay siege against it, and build a fort against it, and cast a mount against it. Set the camp so also against it, and set battering rams against it round about. Moreover, take thou unto thee an iron pan, and set it for a wall of iron between thee and the city, and set thy face against it, and it shall be besieged. And thou shalt lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. So he is making a small city. And he's making all these toy engines of war. And he's setting all these things up so that the people can see what's about to happen to Jerusalem. He set an iron pan between himself and the city. As if to say there's an iron wall between God and the city, and God's not going to intervene. That's not so bad. But it gets worse. Lie thou also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shall they bear their iniquity of the house of Israel. And when thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year. Therefore thou shalt set thy face toward the siege of Jerusalem, and thine arm shall be uncovered, and thou shalt prophesy against it. And behold, I will lay bands upon thee, and thou shalt not turn thee from one side to another, till thou hast ended the days of thy siege. Not only has he got to build this camp, he's got to lay on the ground on his side, strapped down so he can't move for 390 days, and then 40 days on the other side. It's not over yet. Keep going. Verse 9. Take thou also unto thee wheat, and barley, and beans, and lentils, and millet, and pitches, and put them in one vessel, and make thee bread thereof, according to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon thy side, 390 days shalt thou eat thereof. And thy meat which thou shalt eat shall be thy weight, 20 shekels a day, from time to time shalt thou eat it. Thou shalt drink also water by measure, the sixth part of a hin, from time to time shalt thou drink. And thou shalt eat it as barley cakes, and thou shalt bake it with dung that cometh out of a man in their sight. And the Lord said, even thus shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread among the Gentiles, whither I will drive them. All right? We don't know about these shekels and this amount of weight here. Essentially, he was getting 16 ounces of food a day and getting 8 ounces of water. That was it. All he got. And the food, now this is gross. Now, God didn't force him to do this. Ezekiel said, well, that's too much. The food wasn't cooked over human waste. It was allowed to be cooked over animal waste. Can you imagine that? That's terrible. Now let's look at this from what we know about medicine. God's going to strap him in one position and not let him move. Friend, we don't let people lay in a hospital bed for 2 hours without moving because their skin starts to break down. All right? As if I've been healthy, but God's going to ration his food so that he is going to become very thin. Well, that with no activity, he's going to start to waste away. He's going to develop pressure sores. big ones. 390 days, big ones. And then at the end of it, he's going to turn over and lay on his other side, expose all of these things to the open air, and he's going to get them on the other side. And this God had him to do so people would look at his life and see that Ezekiel was following after God and trying to give a message to the people. Very intense physical pain, and no doubt some mental pain too, from being bored to death or just laying there in agony for day after day after day and knowing he had to eat this food. But look what God had told to Ezekiel earlier, verse 18 of chapter 3. "When I say unto the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Yet if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but thou hast delivered thy soul." Ezekiel had to do this. If he didn't give the message, his soul was in jeopardy. But that's strong. Very strong. But fortunately, that's not the command that we have. We haven't been given this kind of a command. God inflicted pain on his body. But that's nothing compared to what Hosea went through. Let's turn over a few more pages. We had grouped together right here Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Daniel, who all were pre-exilic and exilic prophets. And then, interestingly, right after that, we get Hosea. And Hosea prophesied to Israel, not to Judah. Now, Israel had been carried away into captivity 180 years earlier by the Assyrians. And Hosea lived from the time of he lived in the day of Jeroboam the second. That was one of the very evil kings that he lived during his time. Jehu, from Jehu down through Jeroboam the second, for those of you who know your kings. Hosea lived about 60 years before the Assyrians came and took away the people. Now let's remember what Israel did to God and what the message was that God wanted delivered. Israel worshiped Baal. And they attributed everything that was around them to Baal. They had fallen very far into idolatry. Sexual practices were part of the worship of Baal. Whoredoms and harlotry. And God speaks about these things. So he wanted a prophet who could deliver this message, but he created in Hosea a prophet that could speak from his own heart about it. Hosea chapter 1. Verse 2, "The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, Go and take unto thee a wife of whoredoms, and children of whoredoms, for the land that hath committed great whoredom, departing from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son." And that sounds right off the bat that God told him to go take a wife that was a harlot. But I don't know that we can think that. How did God have a man of God deliberately marry a harlot? I think that what these words mean here, he was to take a wife of the people of Israel, and the people had committed whoredoms. We're going to see in just a second what happens, but I have to think that quite possibly in the early phases of their relationship, Gomer was a good person and was true to Hosea. So she bare him a son, and the Lord said unto him, Call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it came to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Alright, and she conceived again, and bare a daughter. Doesn't say it's Hosea's daughter. And God said unto him, Call her name Loruhamah, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God, and I will not save them by the bow, nor by the sword, nor by battle, nor horses, nor by horsemen. Now when she had weaned Loruhamah,
she conceived and bare a son. No mention of Hosea. And God says what he's going to name that child. So Gomer, it's true to Hosea, they have a child, she's got two more. And then it catches up to her. And now the message of God starts to come out of Hosea. Because now Hosea is able to speak from the heart about a wife that betrayed him. Hosea is speaking from the heart. See, God considered and spoke often of his relationship with Israel as if he was the husband and Israel was the wife. And so Hosea begins to speak. Chapter 2. Let's read verse 2. Now these are God's words, but they are coming straight from the heart of Hosea. Let's listen. Plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife. Neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts. Lest I strip her naked and set her as in the day she was born, and make her as a wilderness and set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. And I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. For their mother hath played the harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers that give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and mine drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns, and will make a wall that she shall not find her path. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then it was better for me with me than now. For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. See, God had blessed Israel. God had given these blessings. But the people attributed to Baal. And all this time, God has been having this relationship with Israel as if they are a wife that went astray. Now Hosea can speak from his heart. And all of these things sound terrible. All of these things sound awful, what he's going to do to Israel. And then something changes in his tone. Let's look at verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably unto her. And I will give her her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. The valley of Achor. A while back, we talked about the sin of Achan. Remember, Joshua went into the battle of Jericho, and Achan took of the booty of Jericho. He took of the spoils and hid it. Because of that, they lost the next battle at Ai. Because of that, when it was discovered, Achan and all his family and all his possessions were stoned in the valley of Achor, which meant the valley of pain. He says, I'm going to give them the valley of Achor for a door of hope. In other words, they're going to go through this terrible time, but this is going to teach them a lesson. And she shall sing there, as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be at that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishai, and shall call me no more Baali. For I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall be no more remembered by their name. Several things start to go on here. He starts talking about what's going to happen to Israel down the road. See, Israel's going to be taken by the Assyrians. It's coming. This is their trip to the Valley of Achor. They're going to be taken there, and they're never going to exist in the same way again, but the people will go on. And the Jews still do. Some of the things that are said here are true even to this day to them. Let's look now what happens in verse 3. All this has happened so far. It's been bad. Hosea's wife has committed whoredoms against him. She had children with twice that weren't his. Look what the Lord God tells him to do next. Then said the Lord unto me, go yet. Love a woman beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods and look to flagons of wine. Huh. Go get her, he says. Go get Gomer. So I bought her to me for 15 pieces of silver and for a homer of barley and half a homer of barley. That didn't mean a lot to us. 15 pieces of silver was half the price of a slave. half the price of a slave. That's what she was worth. Perhaps somebody owned her. Perhaps somebody was making money off of her for her services. And he bought her from this individual for that much. Now, we can only speculate that perhaps many years went by, and the reason that she was so worthless was that she was past her prime. She wasn't making a lot of money for this guy, and it's better for him to get rid of her. Now, perhaps years went by, and God says, I want you to go get Gomer. And he did. Verse 3, and I said unto her, thou shalt abide with me for many days, and thou shalt not play the harlot, and thou shalt not be for another man, so will I also be for thee. And here we get a prophecy for the future. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, and without a prince, and without a sacrifice, and without an image, and without an ephod, and without teraphim. Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days. Israel has not had a king in many, many years. They have not had a king. They have not had a prince. And after about 70 AD, they have not shed blood for sacrifices. Their system became internalized. They don't offer sacrifices now the way they once did. The ephod was destroyed when Jerusalem was taken. All of these prophecies. But God says, I want you to go take Gomer. All the pain that she caused, he says, I want you to forgive her and let her be your wife again. As the image of God himself, Israel had done such terrible things to God, and yet he took them back. And he takes us back today. We've got three components of life here. We've got a physical side. We've got a physical side that Jeremiah faced, and that Ezekiel surely faced. And then we've got a mental, emotional side here that Hosea faced head on. Had to face it. And yet they were called to do these things. What about the New Testament? Two quick passages to try to complete our thoughts tonight. We have to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. The Apostle Paul was no stranger to pain. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Verse 23, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. In labors more abundant. In stripes above measure. In prisons more frequent. In deaths oft. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods. Once was I stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and day have I been in the deep. In journeyings often. In perils of water. In perils of robbers. In perils of mine own countrymen. In perils by the heathen. In perils by the city. In perils in the wilderness. In perils in the sea. In perils among false brethren. In weariness and painfulness. In watchings often. In hunger and thirst. In fastings often. In cold and nakedness. He went through a lot of physical pain, and he never waned in his service to God. He keeps talking about this very concept, chapter 12, verse 7. He says there, and lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan, to buffet me, lest I should be exalted above measure. For this thing I besought the Lord thrice, that it might depart from me. Paul didn't like it. And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in necessities, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. We've got these attributes in our lives, physical, emotional, spiritual. Paul says, in spite of the physical, I remain strong spiritually. In spite of what I'm going through physically, that I won't get rid of it, and it's terrible. Paul was like the woman with the stroke that cried. He says, I want it gone. But in spite of that, he stayed true spiritually. Well, that covers that part. That makes sense to us. It doesn't make it easy, but we see the example in the Apostle Paul. What about the harder thing? What about the middle pain? What did Jesus say? Matthew chapter 10, verse 34. This is hard, what Jesus says here. We can't hardly imagine this. Some of you perhaps can. Perhaps some of you live this. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against the mother-in-law. A man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. Man, you know, it's one thing to understand that there's a physical pain, and although it can definitely affect our mental state of mind, it can. And I'm not one to claim that I'm above that. If I got a bad headache, I don't want to talk to anybody. But we can see the separation there. We've got bad physical pain. It's easy to see that we can still stay spiritual and still stay close to God. But Jesus doesn't let us off the hook for emotional pain. Jesus says, I didn't come to bring peace. If your mother or your father or your son or daughter would separate you from being my servant, then if you let that happen, you're not worthy of me. That's emotional pain, isn't it? And he tells us that we should still try to search for him and seek him. So we've got pain. We've got pain that's real pain, physical pain. We've got emotional pain. And then we've got our spiritual lives. And what is left for us? What is it that we should strive for spiritually? It's from the book of Matthew, chapter 6. And the verse we know so well, verse 33. Jesus Christ tells us, but seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Friends, pain is a part of life. Pain can be terrible. I've seen it devastate people's lives. And yet, we have a spiritual component, and our instructions are to seek God first, no matter what. It's easy to seek Him first when we feel good. It's easy to seek Him first when we're on a emotional high. But Jesus Christ's instructions were to seek Him first with no other qualifiers. Even in pain, emotional pain, physical pain, put God first. And that's something, friends, that it's easy to talk about from an intellectual standpoint. It's easy to talk about on paper, so to speak. But it becomes very tough for us when we actually have to do that. And I know some of you do, perhaps every day. And perhaps some of you have given or are about to give lessons that would be encouragement for us when we face these trials. Lessons about persistence. Lessons about endurance. Lessons about patience. And we need these kind of thoughts. But I think we also need to realize that even when we face hard times that affect us in ways that perhaps have never been affected, our highest calling is still to put God first in our lives. These are our thoughts for this evening. I hope that you'll consider them. I hope that they've benefited you. We offer an invitation at this time. It's an invitation we offer frequently. An invitation to allow the blood of Jesus Christ to cover our sins through baptism. We also offer an opportunity for us to ask for others to pray for us. And if any desire either one of these, please let it be known as together we stand and as we sing.